This is St. Louis Public Radio. Winston Churchill cemented his place in history with his leadership in World War II. But long before he became Prime Minister, Churchill was striving for greatness through his military exploits in what's now South Africa. Author Candace Millard wrote the recently released Hero of the Empire about Churchill's tenure as a soldier in the Boer War. Before speaking at the St. Louis County Library on Thursday, Millard talked with St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum about why Churchill was such a fascinating subject.
Why Winston Churchill?
Why not Winston Churchill? How can you resist him, right? It's a very daunting subject, obviously. They say there have been more books written about him than anyone but Napoleon and Jesus, which I believe. But what interested me about Churchill is how he came to be, how he came to be one of the most famous people on the planet, one of the most powerful and effective leaders. Where did he come from? And the answer is all of that happened, developed, the very beginnings of it took place in South Africa.
Obviously, Churchill has a lot of resonance in Missouri because he made a very famous speech here, and he kind of partnered with an everyman character, Harry Truman. But from reading the first part of your book, he's anything but an everyman. He's like an aristocrat. He had like servants in the field of war. Did you feel some cognitive dissonance between kind of how Churchill is perceived in a place like Missouri and what he was really like growing up, basically?
It surprised me, and I think it would surprise a lot of Americans, for one thing, to see where he was born, which is Blenheim Palace. Some people may have been there, but it's this extraordinary, enormous, and opulent palace where he was born. He's a direct descendant of the first Duke of Marlborough. He was born into the highest ranks of the British aristocracy, and obviously that affected him, you know, and he was born at the height of the British Empire and was an unabashed imperialist, but became a voice of the people. And again, you see that very, very early in his life. Although he was born into this elite circle, he was incredibly ambitious, and he wasn't sitting around waiting for things to happen to him. He made them happen for himself.
When you got about to writing this book a few years ago, or thought about writing about Winston Churchill, did you know you were going to write about the chapter in his life where he fought in the Boer War?
I did. I had heard this story about 25 years ago, so it was always in the back of my mind. All I knew was the very basic outlines that he had been taken as a prisoner of war and he escaped. And it just stunned me because I had not heard that story before. And you think, Winston Churchill? This happened to Winston Churchill? And after I turned in the manuscript for my second book, I was thinking about it some more, and I did some more research. And, you know, the Boer War is really the beginning of modern warfare. This is really the launching pad for Winston Churchill's career, and it was just a fascinating story in itself.
I can't imagine three different people than Teddy Roosevelt, James Garfield, and Winston Churchill. Tell me some commonalities between these three characters and maybe some extreme differences, because I assume there's more differences than there are similarities, but obviously they all led their countries at some point.
I actually saw a lot of similarities between Winston Churchill and Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt obviously was also born into great wealth, but was incredibly inherently ambitious, was very arrogant, drove everybody crazy. They were both incredibly well-read, as is true of James Garfield, as you know. All of them were extraordinarily talented writers, understood the power of words and were able to use it. And what I think they all have in common is I think that they were natural-born leaders. And the reason I think that is that not only were they confident themselves, but they could transfer that confidence to another person. It was contagious. So Winston Churchill, he believed in himself. He believed that he was extraordinary. He believed that he was destined for greatness. He used to say that he had faith in his star. But he could look at someone else and say, you know what, you are also extraordinary. You are also brave and resourceful, and you can do incredible things. And you believed it. And as a result, you know, look at World War II. And so I think this was true for Theodore Roosevelt and for James Garfield as well.
Did you think when you were writing this book, Winston Churchill risked so much to be a part of history, and if he would have died in what is now South Africa, the world may have been so much different?
I do think that. And I think he could have died again and again and again. You know, so by the time he goes to South Africa, he's only 24 years old, but this is his fourth war on three different continents. He had killed men. He had nearly been killed himself many times. He had watched many of his friends, not just killed, but slaughtered. And it's just mind-blowing to imagine if Winston Churchill had died at any of these points as a very young man, always launching himself into not just a battle, but the most brutal battle he could find, and trying to get attention. You know, he rode a white pony on the battlefield in British India to everyone's astonishment and horror. And I don't know. I mean, I think that I can't imagine anybody who could have taken his place and played that particular role during World War II with the same effect.
One of the things I was kind of amazed about was not only how ambitious Winston Churchill was from reading the first part of your book, but how so sure he was that he was going to be this great leader of his country. Where do you think like that type of supreme ambition came from? And some people would say that that's very arrogant of somebody to believe when they're that young. So I guess that's two questions. Where do you think it came from? And how did he prevent himself from veering into just being super arrogant as opposed to super ambitious?
He was super arrogant. He didn't prevent himself. I mean, he himself would admit it. And I think that one of the things is, so he, you know, he's a direct descendant of the first Duke of Marlborough, and he feels that legacy very much. The John Churchill, the first Duke, was considered to be one of, if not the greatest general in British history. His father, Lord Randolph Churchill, had been Chancellor of the Exchequer, leader of the House of Commons at a very young age. And Churchill himself felt that he would do all of these great—he felt it very, very strongly. In fact, one of my favorite quotes, he writes to his mother this letter when he's fighting in the Battle of Malacan, and he says, you know, I don't believe that the gods would create so potent a being as myself for so prosaic an ending.
I read that,
so
and I was like, whoa, you
know? I know. And but what's interesting is that everybody else saw it too. And again and again and again, when I was doing research, I just had to laugh because people would say, you know, I cannot stand that kid Winston Churchill. He's going to be prime minister one day, but I can't stand him. You know, he got on everyone's last nerve.
I think the other thing that stuck out at me is he was fighting all these battles in colonial wars. It was Britain trying to control a lot of colonies where the people were not white, you know, especially in India and Africa. Mm-hmm. And I guess the Boer War was basically this one Caucasian-driven empire versus, I guess, settlers of another Caucasian empire trying to rule an area that was probably predominantly non-white.
What sort of, especially when
you were researching and when you went to South Africa, what sort of did that dynamic come into your mind, and how do you think it blended itself into the book, basically?
It did, very much. And it was really important to me to the extent that I could, tell the story from the point of view of native Africans. Because as you say, so you have the British Empire, and then you have the Boers, who are largely Dutch, German, and Huguenot settlers. They've been there for centuries, but, you know, this is Africa. So people had been living there, you know, not for hundreds or thousands of years, but for millions of years. And so you have this white man's war over land that doesn't belong to either of them. And it was really important for me to make that point. And I did make it very strongly several times in the book. And I go back and I talk about the Bantu people, which were the Zulu and the Xhosa, which would end up being Nelson Mandela's tribe. I talk about Shaka Zulu. And in particular, it was really exciting for me. I found this man named Solomon Pleike, who was a native African, who was one of these just extraordinary people you find every once in a while in history. He somehow was largely self-taught. He knew about 8 different European languages, as well as many different African languages. And so he would serve as a translator for native Africans who were accused of crime, hauled into Boer courts, and had no idea what was being said. He started newspapers, and he wrote a diary during the Boer War, observing the British and the Boers. And it's incredibly beautiful. And I quote from it in the book.
I wanted you to talk kind of about your process for writing this book. I've been told that you actually went to South Africa. Did you also go to England and try to look through some of Churchill's personal writings? I would like to give our listeners a sense of how this book came together, basically.
I did. I spend a lot of time researching for each of my books. It's to me, it's the best part of the process. I really love it. I spend as much time as I can until it kind of becomes ridiculous and I need to move forward. But so I of course, I went to England. I spent a lot of time in Cambridge, which is where the Churchill archives are. I went to Blenheim Palace. They have archives there as well. I went to the National Army Museum, the archives at Kew. I met with Churchill's granddaughter. And then I went to South Africa. I spent several weeks there. And everywhere you look, there's something about the Boer War. There are markers for battlefields. There are museums. There are libraries. But specifically to this story, I went to where Churchill was captured. I went to where he was kept as a POW in Pretoria. And it's incredible. The building is now a public library, but there's still a drawing of the map of South Africa on the wall that these officer prisoners drew. There's a trap door in the floor where Churchill was kept, the room where he was kept, where they were thinking about tunneling their way out. I went to where he hid in a coal mine shaft for 3 days with white rats. I went into what's now Mozambique, was in Portuguese East Africa, and that's where he made his way to freedom. And the British consulate he went to, same building. So it was so much fun.
How do you think Churchill is perceived in a place like South Africa, not only among descendants of white settlers, but also of the non-white natives, so to speak?
Well, obviously, South Africa has changed a lot for the better. You know, the British Empire, they reassured, or they promised native Africans that things would get a lot better for them after the Boer War. And of course, that didn't happen for a long, long time. It took a long time till we got to Nelson Mandela. And South Africa is still going through growing pains and is changing. And so, you know, obviously there's not a lot of respect for Winston Churchill, or, you know, certainly not for any of the Boers who were the precursors to the Afrikaners. So the changes are definitely for the best.
Because it's such a massively different perception of how maybe Churchill is perceived here in America or Europe, but probably right. In former colonies all over the world. I don't know if he's seen so magnanimously, just because I don't know if just Britain as a whole is seen magnanimously, because they took over countries, essentially. Is that your sense as well?
Yes, of course. And let's be honest. I mean, as much as there is to admire about Winston Churchill, he was far from a perfect man. I mean, he was an unabashed imperialist. He was an elitist. You know, he was a product of the time in which he was born and the station in which he was born. You know, he was born in the highest ranks of the British aristocracy during the Victorian age and in the height of the British Empire. And so you kind of have to take him as he was and look at him clear-eyed.
I think that the most visually striking thing about this book is like his dramatic escape from imprisonment and the fact that he traveled such a long way and then I guess actually came back into battle, so to speak.
Right.
It's hard to imagine someone like Winston Churchill, who, again, the popular image of him is just like this roly-poly man who smokes cigars,
right,
being such like an action hero. Like, how did you kind of relegate those two images into this book, essentially?
And that was important to me because I think that most of us, when we think of Winston Churchill, we think of this old man sending young men into war. But the truth is that no one understood better and few understood as well as he did the real cost and tragedy of war, because he had seen it himself up close again and again and again as a very young man. And yes, so he escapes from prison. He makes it across almost 300 miles of enemy territory by himself, without a map, without a gun, without food, without a compass. He doesn't speak the language. It's just really this extraordinary escape, this extraordinary adventure, and it, you know, it makes him a national hero.
I think in your other two books that made them so successful and interesting, you're taking, first of all, not many people know a lot about James Garfield, so you're taking a person that's not known by a lot of people and making him more known. With River of Doubt, you're taking a period of Teddy Roosevelt's life after he was president and kind of giving people a sense of what happened in South America. Well, you're taking a similar approach here, that you're taking an episode of Winston Churchill's life that people know about because there's probably been other books written about it, but from a popular, you know, mass standpoint, it's not super well known. Is that kind of what you were trying to do here by focusing on this particular episode?
Well, what interests me, if you look back in history, I think often where our eye travels to, or what we remember, are those big public moments of triumph or infamy. But what interests me are actually the private moments of struggle, where someone is, they're sick or they're desperate or they're scared, and they're trying to find their footing. And to me, at least, that's where true nature is revealed. If you really want to understand somebody, that's what you look at. And so for Theodore Roosevelt, you know, on the River of Doubt, he's terrified, not for himself, but for his son. And he gets to a point where he's going to take his own life. And I think you see him for the man he was, not the statesman or the crazy cowboy. And James Garfield, you know, everyone said as he was dying, this horrible death over 3 months, that you could see him so clearly. And he himself called it the bed of the sea. This is where a person is most exposed. And the same is true for Winston Churchill when he is sort of making his way across these hundreds of miles. And he's scared, you know. I mean, the Boers are humiliated, they're enraged, and if they find him, there's a very real risk that they will kill him. And he keeps fluctuating between incredible confidence and desperation. And at one point, he stops, and, you know, he was not a religious man, but he prays. He prays for help and guidance. And I think, again, you can truly see who he was at his core.
Do you have any idea who you're going to write about next? Or are you just trying to get through this humongous book tour?
I'm trying to get through the book tour. I do have some ideas. I have sort of three hopefuls, but I just need time to. So I'm looking forward to December when I can go back in my office and close the door and just start reading and researching, which is what I love best.
My last question is, as you mentioned on the outset, there's been a lot of things written about Winston Churchill, and there's a built-in audience that I think, you know, makes a book like yours so wanted by a lot of people. Was that challenging, the fact that you were writing about a subject who is well known compared to someone like Garfield who was less known? Or was it basically the same challenge that you're trying to find the private moments in somebody's life and show it to the world, essentially?
It was daunting. It really was, not just because there are so many books written about Winston Churchill, but because they've been written by some of the greatest minds in history and biography. But I felt like I sort of had these friends with me along the way because I had read so much and I had spent so much time trying to understand who he was and this time in his life. And it's interesting because actually not that many people know this story. The more people I talk to, even when there's a British publisher for this book and I went and met with the staff there at Penguin Allen Lane, and many of those people didn't know this story either. I think sort of like with Theodore Roosevelt, The River of Doubt was after his active political career. This is before Churchill's political career. So I think that a lot of people have forgotten it, and it's such an incredibly fascinating story, but it's also incredibly important in the making of the man we know.